This is Tonya Kopel interviewing Leo Sternbach for the Center for History of Chemistry in his office at Hoffman La Roche in Nutley, New Jersey, on March 12, 1986. Dr. Sternbach, I would like to go back a little bit in your life and ask you a few questions about your early childhood. I have seen from your curriculum that you were born in 1908 in Abbazia, which was then Austria, and that your parents were not from Austria. So I would like to ask you how you came to Austria.
My parents were Austrians, you know, that belonged to Austria at that time. My father was from Galicia, Poland, from Krakow. No, he was really from Przemysl, which is in the eastern part of Galicia, and my mother was from Hungary. And they met in Abbazia, where my father had the pharmacy.
I see. Now, this was considered to be the Austrian-Hungarian Empire?
Or? Yeah, this was. Before World War I.
Yeah. So this is really, you were really Austrian in this?
Yeah, at that time I was Austrian.
So your father had a pharmacy, and what language did you talk?
We talked at home, we talked German, because my father knew Polish, both of them knew German, my father and my mother. But my father didn't know any Hungarian, and my mother didn't know any Polish at that time.
I see. So you were really...
So the lingua franca was German.
Was German. And your schooling then, well, let me ask you first, did you have any brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I had a brother at that time who was three years younger than I, and he died after we moved to Poland of scarlet fever.
And that was your only brother?
That was my only brother.
So you were then...
At that time, this one was when I was already 18 years old.
I see.
But at the time when I was born, till I was 18, I had the brother.
See, what was your father's name?
Michael Sternbach.
Sternbach.
Yeah.
And your mother? Your mother's maiden name?
Cohn, C-O-H-N, and Piroska is a Hungarian name. It's P-I-R-O-S-K-A.
Good. I'm glad you're.
Because I was already interviewed sometimes, and then I know that this is valuable.
And your father was a pharmacist.
Yeah.
Where did he study?
He studied in, I think, in Lviv, Lemberg. Mm-hmm. He studied and finished pharmacy there, and then after the war he worked in. After he finished his studies. He worked in pharmacies in, I think, mostly in Krakow. And then he moved to Abbazia way before I was born. It must have been around 1906 or maybe even earlier, 1903 or something. He moved to Abbazia and rented there a pharmacy. It was not his own pharmacy. He rented it and led it and had quite a good business as long as Austria existed, including Abbazia.
Yes.
This was the spa, the seashore spa of Austria.
Oh, it was.
Yeah.
I see. Your mother, did she have a university education?
No. My mother was Höhere Töchterschule or whatever.
And she was a housewife.
She was a housewife. Yeah.
Now, did you have any memories of the pharmacy? I know when I was young, pharmacies always had some
wonderful smell. Oh, yeah, I did. I helped even my father sometime. Well, I came in, during the First World War, my father couldn't employ anybody, so he was alone there. And we had supper in the pharmacy because he kept it open till 8 and even later, and sometimes my mother then made some eggs or something for our supper, and sometimes I was sitting there where my father had a 15-minute nap after lunch, and I was sitting there and taking care of people who came in. I told them, please wait a minute or so.
That must have been fascinating.
Yeah, it was.
Children like to sell.
Yeah, well, I couldn't sell at that time. I was, well, between 7 and 10 years old. So.
I see. But it must have influenced your career choice, because I see that you later studied pharmacy.
Yeah, I studied pharmacy because my father had the pharmacy in Krakow, in Poland. And at that time, the sins on sons and daughters of pharmacists had preference in acceptance at the university. There were only 30 places in the pharmacy students' studies. So they had the preference, and I was accepted there as a son of a pharmacist.
I see. Well, could we go back to your grade school, because you started your schooling at such a crucial time.
Yeah.
In 1914?
Yes, in 1914. This was a German school. I mean, this was in Austria, so it was German. Everything was in German. And it went on till, in any case, till I finished the elementary school. The elementary school was 4 years at that time. And then we had 8 years of higher education. And the 4 years I did in German, in German language. And then the Italians occupied Abbazia after the First World War was over. That was in 1915.
So it was not actually involved in the war. The war did not affect your early schooling? No.
We heard some fighting on the Isonzo, some shooting by artillery, and one bomb fell in the woods in Abbazia. Which made a hole like that.
Yes.
That was just it, about 2 meters in diameter.
Oh,
these were the old bombs.
And your father was not drafted, or?
No, he was not. He even volunteered. He wanted to be drafted, but they didn't take him as a pharmacist, I think.
They
and he was
him.
Yeah, and he was maybe already overaged.
Yes, I
for
see.
Them.
I see. So you must have been a good student in grade school already.
No, I wasn't very good. I was good in some subjects. In mathematics, I was good.
Mathematics
and in physics, in science, I was good.
But in grade school, you didn't have this specialized training, or did you?
What is grade school? School?
I'm sorry, primary school.
Primary, the elementary school.
Elementary school.
School. There we had just reading, writing, and mathematics, and I don't know whether we had a little bit of sciences.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, by far not. Yeah, not as much as here. And then I went to a. Then I started the gymnasium in Abbazia, and that was closed. And as soon as it was a German gymnasium, and as soon as the Italians came, it was closed, and only Italian schools existed then.
Did they force you to learn to change the language?
No, I mean, I learned Italian. At that time we started to learn Italian, and I knew some fairly well, but not enough to continue my studies. So we learned privately. I learned privately with two or three others. We brought a high school professor from Austria to Abbazia, and he taught us in German. And then I took the exams in Villach in Kern.
I see.
After yearly exams. And we did that for 2 years, I think, and then some other people, educated people, took over in Abbazia and taught us. But this didn't work very well. We just barely passed the exams. So later on, when I was 13, in the fourth grade of high school, I was brought to Villach and went there to the high school. I was put in a pension to a Mrs. with a Mrs. Scheuchzer, and Scheuchzer is a street in Zurich, Scheucher.
And you then went through gymnasium there for how long?
For 8 years.
For 8 years?
Yeah.
Now that was from 1914 to 1922?
To 1914? 1914 I started elementary. That was from 18 to 26.
Right. We have to keep the dates straight. Now, in high school, you must have, as you already mentioned, developed or shown, demonstrated.
Yeah, I already knew before I entered high school. After in the first or second year of high school, I knew that I want to be a chemist.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did.
You went to chemistry, into chemistry through pharmacy.
Through pharmacy, And I knew that my father wanted me to be a pharmacist and take over the pharmacy.
And you wanted to be a chemist.
Yeah.
Did you have chemistry in high school?
Very little. In those times you had maybe for 1 or 2 years 1 hour of chemistry a week.
I see.
It was very deficient.
Some laboratory?
No laboratory.
But you were good in mathematics.
I was good in mathematics, and I had my own laboratory, which was my windowsill, where I ruined several windowsills. And even when I was in Villach, the Mrs. Scheucher, then I ruined her windowsill.
At home? I mean in your... where you live?
Where I lived.
In Villach.
And my parents had then to pay for the repair or replacement of the windowsill.
No wonder your father didn't want you to study chemistry. Now, at age 16, which would be in 1928, you went back to Poland. So what was your educational status at that time?
At age a little bit earlier.
A little bit earlier?
Yeah, could have been. We went to Poland when I was 15, which would be 1923.
Mm-hmm.
My parents moved back to Poland. And I moved with them. Let me see, how was it? But I was sent before that to the... No, okay, shall we correct the whole thing?
Fine.
When I was in fifth grade, this means when I was 5 plus 7 is 12, in 1920, my father knew that he will get a pharmacy concession in Poland, or in 1920 or 21. And then they started to prepare for that and sent me, since I had to be away from home anyway, sent me to the German-speaking gymnasium in Bielitz, Bielsko.
I see, Bielsko.
Yeah, in Poland.
And that was German-speaking?
German-speaking,
Poland.
Yeah. That was, they had two German-speaking gymnasia in Poland, one in Bielitz and the other in Stanislau, because there was a German colony, a colony of Germans.
And so you finished your gymnasium in Poland?
In Poland.
In German?
In German, but I had to learn Polish very intensively, because that was every day an hour of Polish. I had to pick up everything I hadn't had for 3 years, and then go on from that.
So you were really bilingual by that time?
Well, Polish didn't, it was very difficult to learn it. I had to learn it for the whole time, and even when I went to the university, my Polish wasn't perfect.
at the university, yeah, which you now entered, okay, in the University of Krakow?
Yeah, the Jagiellonian University.
There you had to speak, the instruction was in Polish.
In Polish, there everything was in Polish.
And you were enrolled in this pharmacy curriculum.
Yeah.
And that was a school of pharmacy. I guess it was a core curriculum.
Yeah, it was attached to the Department of Philosophy, and you got the Master of Pharmacy after 3 years. The pharmacy curriculum took 3 years.
So you got it in 1929.
Nine. Did I say so, or?
Yeah.
Then it must be correct. Yeah.
Curriculum.
Yeah.
And you took, of course, chemistry courses. Did you take more?
No, during pharmacy, our time was completely filled out.
Pharmacy.
Yeah.
But it had.
It had chemistry, quite a lot of chemistry, laboratory work, inorganic, organic chemistry. Not medicinal chemistry specifically.
And no biochemistry.
No biochemistry, no. We had also botany and basic botany, and then plant. We learned about plant, about drug, about plants that give drugs. Mm-hmm. And so...
Pharmacology?
But pharmacognosy, which means the... to recognize plants.
I see.
We had nothing with nothing. Animal experiments to do.
Uh-huh. I see. Were there any professors that you found especially stimulating and that who would have influenced you or confirmed you in your
I don't think so. I later on continued with Professor Dziewoński, Dziewoński, the N has an apostrophe on top, Dziewoński, and he was the professor of organic chemistry, and then I enrolled, then I applied to him to make the PhD with him. And he accepted me, and there I stayed. I made the PhD and stayed on as an assistant.
So you went from the School of Pharmacy to a graduate program in chemistry.
Yeah, in organic chemistry. I had really to add very little to my education and just mostly work on my doctor's thesis.
I see.
A little bit crystallography and things which we did not have as pharmacists.
And your doctoral thesis was concerned with...
With dye stuffs, with... don't know the title anymore.
Thio-indigo dyes?
Yeah, it was with thio-indigo dyes. And
you worked a lot with aromatic amines.
Yeah, with aromatic...
from your publication.
Yeah, with... with naphthylamine and later on I worked with chloroaniline and so on, but the first publications with Dziewoński, that was just that naphthotio-indigo.
But it did get you into heterocyclic compounds.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
Proved to be important for later. Was there anything in the dye field that came out of it?
This naphthothioindigo, this was a synthesis of this naphthothioindigo, which was a dye stuff, but of not great value. It was a reddish dye, a brownish reddish dye, and it wasn't very important. It was not practically valuable.
I see. You had some special talent, I read, for crystallization.
Yeah, I love to crystallize, and I always did. I love to have crystalline compounds, and in Switzerland, some of them said that I can even crystallize Swiss cheese.
Did you have any colleagues that you met again later? I remember at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, yeah, we had a lot of Polish people, so yeah, I wondered if you later...
I had, yes, because in Switzerland there were many Poles. A Polish army or a regiment was pushed over the border and was then interned in Switzerland. They were quite free there, and they even had a university or Hochschule in Winterthur.
Yes,
and
I,
yeah, and I was lecturing there too on organic chemistry.
I see.
Yeah,
but that was later. But while you were still in Poland, were there any people you met again in Zurich?
Yes, that was my friend Heller Bach, who later on came over the bus in the Polish army and ended up in Switzerland.
Yes, I knew Heller Bach.
Oh, you knew him?
I
yeah.
Knew Heller
oh, he
Bach,
was a very good friend of mine.
You mentioned his
yeah,
name someplace,
yeah,
and I was
yeah,
wondering.
Yeah, Jozek, a very
what
good friend of mine.
What was his first name?
Jozek, Josef.
Josef Heller Bach. He was
yeah,
a Polish officer.
Yeah, yeah.
Officer in the Polish army.
Yeah.
Interned,
yeah.
Yes, he worked in the same lab
yeah,
as I did.
Oh, really? Yeah, where at the Poly, at
yes,
in Ruzicka's
yes,
place?
Yes. Yeah. So, to go back here now, was there anything special about the organization at this university? I'd be interested to know
at,
how the labs were organized.
You mean in Poland?
In Krakow.
We had fairly, we had labs with laboratory benches, something across constructed that way that about three or four people worked on one side of the bench, three or four people on the other, and there were maybe four or six benches. And once we had a fire there, a very bad fire. I mean, a girl was distilling.
A girl.
Yeah. A student, a pharmacy student, no, chemistry student, uh-huh, pharmacy student. She was distilling benzene on the steam bath, on the steam bath, but there was a flame under the steam bath.
Oh.
And that caught fire, and it was even much more horrible because her clothes caught fire, and she had a celluloid comb. Mm. Which caught fire and fell into her clothes and burned a hole in her body.
Oh,
and she died.
She died. From the accident?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that must have
yeah,
been a traumatic
that accident. Was terrible, yeah. And then they cut off one, instead of four laboratory benches, then it was three. They cut off one place in order to make it possible to have better communication and better possibilities to running out and moving around.
So it was a relatively small laboratory.
Yeah, well, it could have held seven times eight, maybe 50 to 60 students.
I see.
Yeah.
That many.
Yeah.
Did you have teaching assistants? Was it?
Yeah. Yeah, we had teaching assistants there, and later on I became a teaching assistant in organic chemistry for pharmacists.
You stayed on then as a research assistant,
yeah,
Professor Jevonski,
yeah,
if I pronounce
yeah,
it right. And I noticed that you already had some publications while
yeah,
still in Poland.
Yeah.
While just as a,
yeah,
I guess as a PhD.
Yeah, after the PhD, a postdoctoral
student. Student.
Yeah.
Who published on aromatic amines and
yeah,
on pyrene.
Yeah.
And
on Friedel-Crafts reactions with these
and
aromatic.
That was in what journal? Can you name the journal?
Roczniki Chemii, that's a Polish journal. That means Jahresbücher der Chemie, something like that.
So then in 1937 you went to Zurich. And
yeah, in 1937.
Was that on account of the war that was...
No, it wasn't due to that. It was due to that I didn't have any chance at the university because I was Jewish. So Jevonsky told me it's useless for you to. Yeah, that was that is one of the very strong feelings of the Poles. So Jevonsky was very nice in that respect. He told me, look, you have no chances here. Mm-hmm. And here a grant is coming up by Wyślicki, which has to do with viscose. Mm-hmm. Wyślicki, he was Jewish too, and he was the owner of the biggest viscose, or of the only one, I don't know, viscose plant. Viscose mm-hmm. is nitrocellulose.
Yes.
And plant, and this grant is coming up, and I, Jevonsky, am on the committee, and I will support your application if you apply. And so I did that. He told me, in the world, outside in the world, you will do much better than you can here. Mm-hmm. And so I applied for that and got that grant, really.
And the grant was intended to let you study at the ETH or...
No, wherever I wanted.
Wherever you want.
Wherever I wanted.
I see.
But it was meant for colloidal chemistry.
Uh-huh.
So I first applied for colloidal... I wrote to... To whom did I write? I wrote to Professor Pauli. That's the father of the famous Wolfgang Pauli, who then was in Zurich, who the Pauli principle
yes,
in atomic.
Yes.
Yeah, and that was the father.
His
father.
What was his position?
Wolfgang Pauli, he was professor of colloidal chemistry in Vienna.
I see, in Vienna, not
in Vienna.
Swiss Federal Institute.
No, in Vienna.
Yes.
He was in Vienna, and then I applied to go there and was accepted and came to Vienna, and I hoped that I could work at the same time, maybe half days this colloidal chemistry and half days organic chemistry, which I liked to do, which I wanted to do. So I also, as soon as I was in Vienna and discussed with Professor Pauli what I have to do, I have to do measurements of conductivity in very dilute agar solutions and things like that, which didn't interest me greatly, but that was my chance to get out from there.
So you actually went to Vienna?
Yeah.
I see. And I see a paper here on comparative electrochemical studies.
Yeah.
And I was wondering where that came from.
Yeah, that was in Vienna with Professor Pauli.
We were talking about your work in Vienna with Professor Pauli.
Yeah.
And can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yes, so I did this work with Professor Pauli, but I hoped I could arrange it so that I would work half days in colloidal chemistry and half days in organic chemistry, which I was really only interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to Professor Späth, who was at that time in Vienna. He was quite well known, and went to him and asked him, wouldn't it be possible for me to work half days in your laboratory? But Professor Späth said, no, that's not possible. I cannot, first of all, he cannot take me now because I was not registered with him and he didn't have a space. In addition, half days he couldn't take me anyway at all. So therefore I went to Professor Frenkel. Frenkel, he wrote a book, Arzneimittel Synthese. I can show it to you. It's a rather non-critical compilation of everything that was known at that time about medicine, about medicinals, mm-hmm. about drugs. So I went to him, and yes, he gave me a laboratory place. Yeah, that was on the back. Do you know Vienna?
No, not really.
That was on the Beringer Strasse, well, one of the big streets there, and here, there on the second floor, he had a laboratory, and he had as a laborantin, he had an old lady or an old cleaning woman who cleaned our equipment and who cleaned the floors and everything. But no chemical help, she was not. And so I came there, The laboratory was very miserably heated, so it was quite cold. That was the beginning, I think that was the beginning of March of 37. So I came there and was trying to do things. Then he gave me something which a former co-worker of his has left over. He was working on the synthesis of quinine or isolation of various alkaloids connected with quinine, and there was a lot of dirty mother liquors and in various containers, everything there. And he said, well, you see, you can crystallize, try to crystallize this thing, and so on. And that's me the Lust vergangen.
Could you do that?
No, it was so disgusting, the whole thing. It was a started work which was left in the middle with very nondescript, very ill-described samples. So I decided, I will have to give that up. And I told Professor Frankl that, oh, the foundation doesn't let me work at both places. And I thought I will work more intensively at Pauli's over time, and then go do the next half year with Ruzicka in Zurich. Yeah, at that time I had heard Ruzicka lecturing. It was about, at that time he was lecturing about the first degradation of cholesterol to estrone-like compounds.
In Vienna?
In Vienna, yeah. And so I was very impressed and wrote to Ruzicka whether he would take me, and he agreed to.
You didn't approach him then? You didn't?
No, not then.
And Dr. or Professor Frankl was associated with the university?
No, he was a private docent,
He had
a private, a scientist working on his own.
I see. Yeah. So you were accepted at the ETH?
Yeah, I was accepted at the ETH by Ruzicka.
In 1937?
Yeah. It was, I'm not that sure about the date, but it was September 1st or October 1st in 1937.
As a research fellow?
Yeah, as a research fellow, as a postdoctoral, as you would say here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Postdoctoral research fellow. They accepted me. They gave me a nice working place. There was a Dr. Goldberg, who later on joined Roche, and he greeted me and he acquainted me with everything that was to be done there, and he was very nice to me at that time.
There was a whole group of promising young scientists who later emigrated. Was Rosenkranz there?
Rosenkranz was at the same time. He started his PhD thesis at that time in the same laboratory, Rosenkranz.
And who else?
Who else? Klaus Hoffmann, who is now in Pittsburgh, was there.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, he was the assistant of that lab. Goldberg was Ruzicka's private assistant. Uh-huh. And he was... Klaus Hoffmann was Saal assistant. And then at that time, Louis Grob, who is now professor in... I think in Basel, was at that time studying. He was not even doing his PhD yet. Not Louis, Cyril Grob. Cyril Grob, who is in Basel now. And who else was there? There was a Marxer, who is now with Ziba in Switzerland. And it was quite a good crop at that time.
Later they all left at the beginning of the war, actually, didn't they? All leave for the United States. And
the non-Swiss, yeah.
The non-Swiss, yes.
Yeah, Rosenkranz left, and there was another one, another Hungarian, Kaufmann, who is now in Mexico. Mm-hmm. I saw him just a few years, I think 2 years ago we met in Zurich.
Rosenkranz is now in California?
No, I think he still lives in Mexico.
Still in Mexico.
Mexico. He's a very good bridge player.
Yes, I heard.
And has his system. It's called Romex, you know, from Rosencrantz in Mexico.
Oh, really?
The Romex system he uses in bridge.
And his wife was kidnapped in Washington?
Yeah, was not kidnapped. Yeah, and they recovered, and they didn't. The ransom was also recovered by.
The ransom was recovered.
Yeah, by a bridge player. She was.
Yes.
Kidnapped. Yeah.
By a bridge player.
By a bridge player. Yeah.
Goodness.
So he was not very good at it.
So in Zurich, you worked on terpenes.
On diterpenes with Ruzicka, on abietic acid, and later on dextropyrimaric acid too. Mm-hmm. On these two resin acids I was working with Ruzicka.
Ruzicka got the Nobel Prize when
he got the Nobel Prize at that time, the year before Karrer got it, and
the year before
and they were they didn't like it that Karrer got it, and but the year after that Ruzicka got it.
I see.
Yeah,
okay.
In 38, Karrer got it.
Karrer got it first, and then Ruzicka got it. I thought Ruzicka got it first.
No.
So you must have celebrated.
Yeah, there were. He invited us all to a small, excellent restaurant in Niederdorf in Zurich. You know Zurich?
Yes,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, yeah. Niederdorf, I forgot the name of the restaurant. And he also invited us, for instance, the whole group, for a skiing trip to Unterwasser. And then at that time, the later Professor Ruzicka was, that was Frau Acklin, she was his secretary.
Yes, yes.
And she also made the methyl group determinations in chemistry.
She was a chemist, wasn't she?
No, she was his secretary. She was not a chemist.
She was not, but she knew a lot about chemistry.
Yeah, she must have picked up. She must have picked up. And Furter was there at that time. Furter, the microanalyst, mm-hmm. who later on came to Roche and became, later on, I think, a general director at Roche.
In the United States?
No, in Basel. In Basel.
So you really met a lot of interesting people in the short time you were in Zurich.
Yeah.
You also published a paper with Wolfgang Pauli.
Yeah, that was the Viennese Wolfgang Pauli.
That was not a new connection.
Yeah, no.
So I was wondering about this.
That.
So that was the father
that
of the famous Wolfgang Pauli. You started publishing in Helvetica Chimica.
With Ruzicka. On abietic acid.
Mainly, and diterpenes and abietic acid, yes.
Yeah.
You also started a personal relationship in Zurich.
Future wife.
Could you tell us a little bit?
I lived on Universitätsstrasse 87 with Mrs. Kreutzer. Uh-huh. She rented a room to me, and I lived there. And there I met her daughter, Hertha Kreutzer, whom I later on married.
Was Mrs. Kreutzer Swiss, or was she?
Yes, German? No, she was Swiss.
She was very Swiss.
From she was a dean from Appenzell, so she was.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I see.
Kreutzer was her married name.
The life in Zurich.
I liked it very much.
As compared to maybe the life outside of Switzerland, the war started.
No, I liked it very much in Switzerland, especially because of the landscape of the mountains. I loved the mountains.
You skied?
I skied, and also in summer I made excursions. Uh-huh. Every weekend I was somewhere.
In the mountains?
Yeah. The Uri Rothstock or things like that.
Your personal relationship with Ruzicka, did you know him very well? Or?
Fairly well. I mean, he invited us chemists off and on to something. I know a few times I didn't go. He invited us to ice hockey games and things like that. Yeah. And a few times I didn't go because I just had planned an excursion into the mountains. And he was very nice to his students. And
but
I mean, he kept...
To his
co-workers.
Right. He didn't really know his...
Other students.
Undergraduates.
No, I don't think he did.
No. Count too much.
No, I only knew really his relationship to his doctorands and to his assistants.
So that was a warm relationship?
Yeah, yeah.
A more personal relationship?
Yeah.
He seemed so aloof to the other students.
Yeah. I don't know how it was with the other students. Mm-hmm. I don't know. He was... I mean, he was a Yugoslav originally, and he was very proud when he was working in the whatever it was in the military, where non-military Luftschutz. I think he was working in the Luftschutz, and even he had some laboratory space where people were working, where he would have to analyze gases or something which would be dropped on Switzerland or so. Yeah.
He was quite demanding, wasn't he?
Yeah.
His standards were
high. I remember one of our colleagues, an American colleague, he wasn't there at the usual, at the time we were supposed to be there, and Ruzicka came around and made a big question mark on his bench with crayon. Just asking, where are you?
Where are you? Then you moved to Basel. Now, why did you leave the ETH? I guess it was mostly financial.
No, not so much from my side. I was really encouraged by Dr. Goldberg, who said, look, the time is difficult. The Swiss will be very, it will be very hard for Switzerland to keep so many foreigners, and it will be better for you if you are in industry. And at that time, Furte already had joined Hoffmann La Roche, and he called up, had called up Goldberg that they need a new chemist, some chemists there. And so he, Ruzicka proposed then me and also Grüssner. He was then with Roche. He worked with Reichstein before on vitamin C. Grüssner and I joined Roche then at the same time, which was in the middle of 40, or May or June 1940. We joined Roche then.
Did you work on vitamin C?
No, I didn't, no.
But you knew Reichstein quite.
Yeah, I knew Reichstein. Oh, just from visiting him, I had a friend working at Reichstein's,
and so I knew him
from there.
So you stayed in Basel only 1 year.
Yeah.
You got married?
Yeah.
A year later?
In February.
1941.
Shortly before we came to the States.
Did your fiancée work in Basel?
No, she was in Zurich.
She stayed in Zurich.
And I went over the weekends. I usually went to Zurich.
And then you got married.
Yeah, then we got married.
And then you moved to the United States in the middle of the war.
Yeah, in the middle of the war. By boat at that time. Yeah. And that was quite difficult.
It could be
dangerous because of that. You see, my wife became Polish after she married me.
I see.
According to the then existing law. And she was ausgebürgert. She became a tolerierte Ausländerin at that time because the Swiss were very concerned about foreigners there. Mm-hmm. And so she could still work in the office where she was working, and but she had to she got the letter tolerierte Ausländerin, and we would appreciate if you would leave the country as soon as possible.
I don't believe it.
Yeah, that's what the ship is full.
Yes, right.
Yeah. And so she so And also, I mean, Roche, Hoffmann La Roche in Switzerland was also aware of the situation and was aware that it was very difficult to keep foreigners. So they had to renew my working permit every half year with various excuses that there is nobody in Switzerland who could do the things I could do and so on. And they planned to transfer me to the States, me and many others in the same situation, like Grüssner, who was a Hungarian. But Grüssner couldn't make it because his quota would have come up 14 years later. And I was...
You were Polish.
No, it was not. The Polish quota was miserable too. So, but my quota was, according to the definition, the nationality of my birthplace after Versailles.
I see.
And after the Versailles Treaty, Abbazia was Italian.
I see. It was Italian.
Yeah, so I came on the Italian quota.
And that was not so
free. That was very good, the Italian quota.
I'm surprised because so many Italians emigrated.
I think because of that the quota was good, because it was established according to how many people have entered the country within a certain time. I don't know exactly how. But the Italian quota was very good and the Hungarian quota was miserable, and the Polish would have been miserable too.
So you were lucky and
I was lucky to come. Yeah, there was no difficulty.
You don't remember the name of the boat?
Yes, Serpa Pinto. I think it still exists. It's a small Portuguese boat. The Serpa Pinto, I think that means small snake.
And so you arrived in New York.
In New York, yeah.
You went right
in Hoboken. Yeah, and there they expected us, Furter and Dr. Venner. I don't know whether you knew him. He was with Roche at that time. He was a German, but living in Switzerland, and that was also one of the reasons why he was brought over.
I see.
And also Dr. Eschlimann, I don't know whether you knew him. He was a chemist. He was, despite his name, he was English, because his parents moved to England. Mm-hmm. So he barely spoke High German. He spoke Swiss German and English.
And he was English.
He was English, and he was married to a C.K.D.T. Burkhardt.
Oh, I see. Aristocratic.
Yeah.
Family.
Yeah.
So you came right away to Nutley.
Yeah. We lived first here in an inn for 2 weeks in Montclair already. Mm-hmm. And then we rented a house which was furnished and which we could rent at that time. It was half the house because the upper floor was occupied by other people. We could rent it for $60 a month.
Times have changed.
Yeah. Which was quite good, mm-hmm. because, well, my salary at that time was $80 a week. Yeah, that's what it was.
Your position was?
Senior chemist, which was the lowest level of the PhD, mm-hmm. a senior chemist. Mm-hmm. And then at that time only two levels existed, a senior chemist and the group chief.
And you got settled in very nicely with friends soon.
Yeah.
Mainly with the Hoffmann La Roche.
With the Hoffmann La Roche people, and mainly with the ones who were transferred at that time, because the research department was very small at that mm-hmm. time. It was enlarged by the people who were brought in at that time.
I see.
Max Hofer was one of them. That's the one who invented gantrisin. Mm-hmm. Max Hofer, he was from Czechoslovakia and he was half Jewish. So therefore he was also in need of moving out. And Lindenmeyer, who was a chemist in the plant, his wife was Russian Jewish, so they were brought here too. She's still alive. He died a few years ago. And Goldberg died too. Goldberg was brought over. Goldberg joined then Roche already here.
Mm-hmm.
He was hired in Basel by Dr. Barrell, and he came here as a group chief. First he was meant to be a research director, but it didn't come to that, and he was a group chief.
Well, we should really talk a little bit about your work now.
Yeah, okay.
You have come that far.
Yeah. So when I started here to work here, I had started that already in Basel. When I started to work in Basel, I was working on the synthesis of riboflavin, of B2, was split up in several steps, and I was working on one step of the riboflavin synthesis, and which means the epimerization of arabinose, arabonolactone, arabonic acid to ribonic acid, that I was working on in Basel. And afterwards I made some improvements, and it started to look better and better. And then when I was brought here, then we had as a research director a Dr. Heinz M. Wüst, W-U-E-U-E-S-T, Wüst, and who, I think, two things on top, mm-hmm. and an E, mm-hmm. Wüst. And I didn't like him very much, and we didn't get along very well. So after a while, he still remained research director, but then I was when Goldberg came over, he came over the end of 1941 by plane already, by Clipper. And then I was in his group with Dr. Goldberg. He got a group of people working for him.
But and you still and worked on vitamins mainly?
No, then I worked on the Wüst. I was working, he wanted some arsenicals. Mafarsen became at that time very well known, which was used where Salvarsan was used before as a fairly toxic but easily doseable arsenic preparations, mm-hmm. in syphilis. Mm-hmm. And then I worked on that, and while I was working for Wüst, and then I was transferred to Goldberg, then we started to work on a synthesis of biotin.
Biotin. That was your first big achievement. Was it the technical synthesis of biotin?
Yeah, the technical synthesis of biotin.
That's vitamin B2.
Definitely not B2. It was at one time called vitamin H. Hout, H for Hout.
Oh, I see, yes.
Okay. Yeah. That was biotin. Mm-hmm.
Vitamin H.
Yeah.
That was discovered the structure was elucidated by Duvigneau.
Yeah. Yeah,
1942,
yeah.
And there was a lab synthesis by Harris.
Yes, that was,
so
yeah. The Merck people, yeah, Harris was with Merck.
Uh-huh.
They had a synthesis, but it was completely impractical.
So we
developed a completely different synthesis, which decreased the price. I think at that time, if you would have extrapolated, a kilo would have cost $700,000, and we improved the synthesis so much that we could sell it for $10,000 a kilo.
That's still a lot of money.
Yeah, it's a very expensive one. It's still in that range, I think, biotin.
Was it actually biotinol?
No, biotinol, biotin is an acid, and biotinol was made by a reduction of that acid.
Right.
That we made here, I think, the first ones.
I see, but you were also the one who developed synthesis of biotinol.
No, yeah, because that was made, from the biotin.
I see.
From biotin.
And you got two patents that are among your first patents?
I got 10 patents in the biotin field.
10 patents.
Yeah, with Goldberg.
And they were issued To you?
To Goldberg and me.
Hoffmann-La
Roche. Patents are issued to people here, and the people can sell it to.
To the company.
To the company. I think that was still lately so. Mm-hmm. That I can look there in back of you.
Mm-hmm. Well, it says Biotin, and then it says Goldberg and Sternbach, and then to Hoffmann-La Roche.
Yeah.
That's why I'm asking.
Yeah. No, it's indicated in the title to whom the patent has been sold.
Now, actually, we get into the big story, which is the one for the interview.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, let's see how we make the trans.
Maybe let me ask you, from what I read, the company started to look for new compounds that would be useful as tranquilizers.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
And you had almost, it says, stumbled upon benzodiazepines.
Not quite at that time. No, it wasn't immediately so. No, when we were working on we chemists were asked to synthesize new products, to submit products for testing which would have tranquilizing properties. Roche became very interested in tranquilizers because it was as well a group of very useful drugs, and in addition it was financially profitable too, because these were the times when Miltown first came up, and then chlorpromazine, torazine. So at that time we became very interested in tranquilizers, and we chemists were asked to submit some proposals for the synthesis of tranquilizers, which we then could follow up. So I submitted something, and Dr. Eschlimann, who was our research director here at that time, asked me, let me work on these compounds. However, not much came out of that.
What nature were these compounds?
These were phenothiazines with amino groups hanging on it. Mm-hmm. But not much came out of that. So therefore, I thought it might be worthwhile to start with a completely new group of compounds which would have no relationship to Miltown or to torazine or to anything that was known to have tranquilizing or sedative properties. So I, in looking for such a group of compounds, I thought a group would be for practical purposes very useful if this would be a not very well known group of compounds, and a group of compounds which was readily accessible and which could be readily converted into other compounds. And in thinking about such compounds, it occurred to me that I had worked still in Jevoinsky's time with Jevoinsky on compounds which were at that time known heptoxdiazines. They were formed I came across these compounds during my work with Professor Jevoinsky. These compounds were formed. We didn't want them
really. In Krakow.
We obtained these compounds in attempts to work with amino ketones, with amino benzophenones, by oxymation and dehydration. These compounds were formed. I didn't know that these compounds would form, and looking through the literature I found that it was known that these benzheptoxdiazines can be formed under the reaction conditions we were using. These crystallized very nicely, and they seemed to be readily accessible because you could make various benzophenones or acetophenones with various substituents in the aromatic nuclei.
Why? How did you get the idea that they could be tranquilizers?
Oh, I didn't have the idea. No, I just knew that they are new compounds. Yeah.
I see.
In the contrary, I looked through the literature about the known benzpyroxidiazines and found that that no biological tests were done with the ones which were known. And it was not known whether they had any biological activity or not. So I resynthesized again the compound which I made in Jevoinsky's laboratory and submitted them for testing, and it was found that they did not have any biological activity. But since I liked this group of compounds, these benzpyroxidiazines would be with the amino ketones which I was working at that time. And since it's known that basic side chains very often impart biological activity, I thought it might be interesting to make such benzpyroxidiazines into which an amino group could be introduced. This means which would have a reactive halogen on a side chain. So I started to synthesize some of those compounds. They were quite readily accessible, crystallized well, and which was in those times very important, because that made it possible to isolate a good yield of the compound and to isolate it easily. So I synthesized some of these compounds with a halogen with a chlorine in the side chain, reacted them with various secondary amines, because that you usually use those, because it's known that cocaine has a disubstituted amine in the basic part, and also these the synthetic novocaines, or all these compounds had basic side chains, and the antihistamines which were known at that time and of interest. So I thought, well, we will try to introduce basic side chains into these benzpyroxidiazines. And I really synthesized quite a number of compounds which were submitted to Dr. Randall for pharmacological testing, but none of them was active. Finally then Goldberg, who was at that time my boss and whom I didn't like so much because he moved from Switzerland here, and he was a group chief at Roche. And he told me that, I worked enough with these compounds, they don't lead you anywhere, and why don't you stop this and work on something more useful, things like antibiotics or so.
What time was that, in 1955 or?
That was around 1955, yeah.
So you really gave up this
work? I gave up on this work, but on the side we were still working a little bit on it. So then finally we were working on antibiotics and on various other projects in which Goldberg was interested, and it came to that point that the laboratory was completely filled up with various samples, crystalline and non-crystalline, and mother liquors in Erlenmeyer containers and in bottles, and there was no working space anymore available. Then I told Earl Rieder, my co-worker, we will have to clean up. There is no other way out. So we had to clean up, and we collected. We threw out what looked completely hopeless, but looked half hopeless. We kept, and the compounds which crystallized, we filled up into bottles and labeled them according to our laboratory book numbers. And then while doing this, Earl came to me with two samples. One was the base and the other the hydrochloride. He said these compounds are still obtained from these benzpyroxidiazines, and should we throw them out, or wouldn't it be worthwhile to submit them for testing? So I said, okay, let's submit the hydrochloride for testing. I brought it to Goldberg. Goldberg had to sign all the data sheets. You know, I signed my name, and he as a group chief had to sign. So he signed the data sheet and said, so this is the last compound in the group of compounds which you really stopped to investigate already. And I said, yeah, I also thought so, that this might be the last compound. It will be found inactive, and then at least I can have a nice chemical publication. But Zieda, it was completely different. That compound showed very interesting properties. Dr. Randall compared it in various animal species for anticonvulsant, sedative, and tranquilizing properties in various animal species. That I said, they are even in monkeys. It was even active in monkeys. Mm-hmm. He compared it with meprobamate, Miltown, which was at that time the tranquilizer, mm-hmm. also with chlorpromazine, and even with phenobarbital. And it turned out that this compound had very interesting properties. In some of the tests it was much more potent than Miltown. In some of the tests it was even as potent as phenobarbital, and with chlorpromazine in some of the tests it was better, in others it was less good. So it was worthwhile investigating. Randall asked for more of the compound and suggested, why don't you prepare a few analogues or related compounds so we could test them and find a good product.
What was the laboratory book number? Was it
R05-06-90? Yeah, yes. That's what it
that
was.
That was Librium.
That was Librium, yeah.
That was Librium.
Yeah.
So you did not only have a few good publications,
yeah.
You also had a good product.
Yeah.
But you published about 60 or so papers on quinazoline.
Yeah,
and one for benzodiazepines. Now, how did you? I'd like to you to tell me that story where you identified a compound that was mislabeled.
Yeah, or misidentified
as a quinazoline or as a benzodiazepine.
Okay, I will tell you, and then we see whether there is something.
Or am I jumping ahead here?
Yeah, you are.
All right, then please.
Because we started to work with these compounds, submitted them for testing, and then finally we came to the and then we submitted one compound. That's when we had this cleaning up thing. Then we had these two compounds, which Earl Reed showed me, and shouldn't we test these compounds really?
And you have tested them.
Yeah, then we had tested them and found
well.
That they were active. And then we submitted them for testing. But then even didn't we know what the structure of these compounds were.
Oh, I see. You didn't know what the structure was.
No, the analysis checked. We thought they were heptoxdiazines with a basic side chain. Mm-hmm. And later on we found out that the heptoxdiazines were not heptoxdiazines, but were quinazoline and oxides, and not heptoxdiazines. Heptoxdiazines have the same amount of atoms, just that there the oxygen is part of a ring, of a seven-membered ring. That's what it was assumed that they were.
Yes.
But they were not that. They were quinazoline and oxides, which means they had a six-membered hetero ring, that would be much farther in front.
Yeah, I have it here. I have the.
You have on. You have here on page 11. On page 11, if you look at that. 11 and 10. No, 13, I'm sorry. On page 13, you see the formula 13. We thought we have that, we obtained this, because at that time we already know they are quinazoline and oxides. Mm-hmm. That's a quinazoline and oxide. Mm-hmm. And the heptoxdiazines are shown before. A heptoxdiazine is on page 10. You see, we thought compound 8 had this structure. And then it turned out it really didn't have this structure, but it had the structure 10. Number 8.
Yes.
Was on number 10. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we found out. Mm-hmm. And then we found out, then we reacted it so as to obtain compounds of type 11. Mm-hmm. And later on it was established that these were not quinazoline and oxides, but that they were not heptoxydiazines, but quinazoline and oxides that we knew at that time. And then we reacted compound 12 on page 11. Mm-hmm. Instead of a dimethylamine with monomethylamine. And this was a compound which showed these interesting biological properties shown on page 12. Here's the comparison of the... And then we established that this cannot have the structure of shown on page 13 under 13, that this did not have the expected structure 13, but was the product of a rearrangement which yielded compound 1. Mm-hmm. And this was at that time very difficult. We didn't have the physicochemical possibilities which you have now, so we had to do a total classical structure determination by degradation of the molecule, and found out that beyond any doubt this compound must have structure 1. Mm-hmm. And this was then the compound which underwent then very thorough pharmacological testing. Mm-hmm. In animals, especially it was particularly interesting was its taming properties on monkeys. And then we decided the toxicity was also very good. It had very low toxicity. Then it was established to prepare one of these compounds for clinical testing. We compared several analogous compounds. They had all approximately the same properties, so we thought we might as well stick with compound 1. It was most readily accessible because its starting material is parachloroaniline, which was a commercial product, and all the reactions occurred very readily. So we decided that this is a compound we will, where we will study the chronic toxicity, and which we will prepare for clinical testing.
And you said Eureka, we found it.
Yeah, I beg your pardon?
Eureka, we found it.
Yeah, and this was then. I have here such a timetable of in May 7 we submitted it for pharmacological testing, May 7, 57. See, because this was in 55 we stopped, and then in 57 we...
I could add this as an exhibit, and then maybe we could go on and talk about...
Let me see, do I have another one?
Talk about volume. All right, so you published all told as over 60 papers on series, quinazolines and 1,4-benzodiazepines. And which one was the crucial paper?
The crucial paper was, I think, paper number 2, because we numbered. Paper 1 didn't have a number yet because we did not know that this will be such a series.
Right. So it was number 2?
Yeah, we called it number 2, and number 1 has no number.
And then I noticed that number 4 shows volume. You now went into intensive...
investigation,
we found
that librium was quite unstable in aqueous solution. Under the influence of acid, it decomposed slowly. The aqueous solution became turbid. Now this interested us naturally. We extracted the turbidity, investigated it, and found that this was a molecule which has lost the methyl amino group, which was present in Librium, and was still had the biological activity. It was still a benzodiazepine. And then we investigated these compounds. We continued the investigation of this group of compounds. We found that this compound was a quinazoline and a benzodiazepine and oxide. You see, but also without the methyl amino. This is Valium, yeah. And this was a compound which did not have the methyl amino group anymore. Instead of the methyl amino group,
there was a methyl group
in Valium.
In Valium.
But the first decomposition product was a compound which had the carbonyl group here in the position.
Yes, yes.
And it still had the N-oxide group. So we removed the N-oxide grouping. We found that these compounds were still active. And then we modified.
Were they turbid without the oxide group or what?
No. I mean the methyl amino group that was turbid because it decomposed to give a compound which is very readily the methyl amino group and gives then this N-oxide, this 3-oxide, benzodiazepine 4-oxide, which still had the same activity. Now we went on and modified it even more. We removed the oxygen from the nitrogen, and this compound was still active. And then we tried to vary here on the nitrogen. We could introduce various alkyls. Yeah, in the one position. And then we had a number of such compounds with various substituents in the aromatic ring until we... And that was, we had about 20 compounds on hand. That was in December 1939.
Table 6 and display here.
These are the compounds which are presently on the market or at the time when I wrote
but
this
you
monograph.
Have more. You tested many more.
Many more compounds. And then we found we had a number of compounds on hand. That was in December 1359. And then we decided, Randall and I, we decided, well, we would have to propose another compound to go into, to be prepared for clinical testing, to go into more intensive toxicity studies and a study of their properties in various species. So at that time we looked at what we had, and no compound was significantly different from the other, only the potency varied. And the most potent compound was the one which had the methyl group in the one position. So we proposed this for further clinical testing. This compound then became Valium, and diazepam is the generic name.
And that was in 1963, and this was officially announced?
Introduced. We had it in 59, and from then on the whole thing started to run from then on.
I see.
You see, we published it. We were at that time very careful. We were not satisfied even. We did not publish anything before the patent appeared. Because sometimes, usually it's the usus that you can publish as soon as you have applied for the patent because you are protected from that moment on. But in order to not to open the eyes of the competition, we waited always until really something in written had appeared. You see, then we published.
So then you had a great number of patents.
Unrelated compounds on various compounds. Transformations of benzodiazepines.
And you also discovered one that is called Mogadone.
Yeah, Mogadone,
1965. It's not
It's not marketed here.
In the United States.
You know why? They had difficulties in the beginning, and then they decided, well, they will introduce Dalmain, which is a different compound.
Dalmain is marketed. Now, they are hypnotics
instead of tranquilizers. Yeah.
And from what I see, the difference is mainly the nitro group.
The seventh position of the first ring. Yeah.
And that makes so much difference. What exactly is the difference?
I wouldn't say that it's so much. You see, it's let's
it's
say, it's a scale. It's a scale.
I see.
The lower point of the curve, they are sedatives, and if the sedative properties increase significantly, then they become hypnotics. And especially also the substituent in the lower ring has an effect, like as you can see in the compound which is on the market in Switzerland as Rohypnol.
Yes.
Where do I have it?
112.
Rohypnol, yeah, it has a fluorine. We found that this substituent played also an important role, and we have that in Dalmain, we have that. Dalmain is 105, it's flurazepam, on page 44, the fourth compound.
Yes, you see that.
And we have it in clonazepam, we have a chlorine, clonazepam, clonopine, is called the Rivotril in Switzerland, is marketed as an anti-convulsant.
Which ones are especially attributed to you?
All of them.
All of them?
They're all used, I see. Let me see. No, oxazepam not. Oxazepam was done by Weyers.
But they're mainly...
By Weyers?
They're mainly being developed by you.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's exaggerated. Clorazepam, the tranxine, is also not ours. You see, all the substitutions in three were done by other companies in order to circumvent our patents.
Okay, I see.
Because we never worked, we didn't find it too interesting.
So it was a, there was a big race actually going on between the pharmaceutical companies.
And, you see, ours, Librium, came out in 60, Valium in 63, Cerax, that was the first competitor, by Wyatt in 65.
Yes. That has that the OH, the hydroxyl group.
Yeah. And then we brought Dalmain out, then we brought, then Tranxine is also not ours, that is, I forgot the company which has Tranxine. And then clonopine is ours, then lorazepam. All the compounds with an OH group there are Weiss. But then we made, again on the other page, a compound which is sold very much in Switzerland, and number 50, it's the third down on the on page 45. That is Lexotanil or Lexotan. It's in Switzerland on the market and in other countries too. Here it's still in the hands of the FDA. I don't know whether we'll ever get it.
Do we know the effects of Valium on the central nervous system?
They think it acts on the limbic system.
I see.
And they are now studying receptor sites and points of attachment and also compounds which replace them in the brain. Basel has an interesting compound which liberates Valium from the attachment point and so reverses the effect of Valium. So it can be used if you put somebody to sleep with Valium and you want to stop that, then you inject the other compound that is inactive and replaces Valium, that is an anti-Valium, so to say, anti-benzodiazepine.
On the methodology and rationale behind molecular modification, would one consider it a rather haphazard approach today, or is it still used in the same way?
I think it's still used in the same way. If you make some compounds which have biological activity, then you first study what changes have what effect.
I see.
The relationship between changes and between biological effect. Mm-hmm. You study that. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did, and then we came up with certain regularities which are shown on a, which must be shown here somewhere.
Could you maybe just tell us very briefly? I found that ring A.
The substituent in 7 was crucial, and an electron withdrawing substituent like chlorine or nitro group, an electron releasing substituent like the CH3 group or the CH3O group decreased the activity very significantly.
I see. So one knows pretty much how to
design it now.
In those days,
this was all tested, you know.
It was all trial and error.
Completely. Right. In the lower phenyl group, in the lower phenyl ring, mm-hmm. we knew very soon that the substituent in the para position almost abolished the activity. Mm-hmm. Almost. Whereas in the ortho position, a halogen in the ortho position mm-hmm. increased the activity significantly. Mm-hmm. And you would think ortho and para are very similar, and they are not. Completely different.
You have to sacrifice a great number of animals, I mean, in the laboratories who did the testing.
I guess
that
so.
Is maybe not so done, not so much.
And it's wrong because you see in the animal what the compound does.
Yes.
I mean, you can't matter. And even
if you. Animal testing is.
Is very important. And I think it's very much neglected now by biological testing, which still does not give you all the information you want.
They have started some in vitro testing, like at John Hopkins Medical School.
They do in vitro.
Do you think that's going to be successful? Or?
I am not a great believer in in vitro testing.
You think it's not? They
have the receptor sites now. You know, they can isolate the receptor sites and see whether there is a binding between mm-hmm. Between the active drug and the receptor site by some turbidity in a solution or so. But I am a great believer in tests in animals.
But you have to first know,
First, even for these testings, for this in vitro testing, you have to have first the compound or the group of compounds which you know to have activity in animals.
Right.
And then you can go on with that.
Yes,
because otherwise it's
because we have more
methods,
knowledge about structure activity relation
which we found by testing in animals.
Yes of course. You must have had a good team to work with you on this.
The chemistry, I had a good group of chemists working.
Some people that should be mentioned especially, or?
Well, at that time, Dr. Fryer and Dr. Metlesic, they worked with me closely. They were, and Earl Rieder was the first one in my laboratory when I had only my laboratory to dispose of.
By that time, of course, you were the group leader, or what was your position?
Yeah, I was, first I had my own laboratory, and then I became a group chief, I think.
Group chief. And then you became director of
medicinal chemistry.
Do you remember the year?
I don't need it in my curriculum.
I can look at it.
I don't even know. No, it's not so. Yes, in 66 it seems I became.
So then you really were in charge of the whole research program in medicinal chemistry.
Yeah, but I limited myself really to the benzodiazepines, and other areas I left to the chemists who did mm-hmm. it, who did
in
the work.
Which group?
Yeah.
Well, I think we have a pretty good idea now about your work on Valium and Librium and related compounds. I would like to ask a few questions of maybe a more philosophical nature, or maybe first a more clinical question, and that's the addictive properties of Valium. I read an interview that you gave 10 years ago in Parade, and you at that time considered Valium to be fairly non-addictive. Would you like to?
Well, I would say with people who are not addiction prone, it's really not addictive.
You think it's being abused and not always used for what it was designed?
It might be possible that it was for a while a street drug, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. And I don't know whether it still is or whether
housewives,
it is.
Housewives, street drug maybe.
Yeah. Well, the housewives, yeah, they might have used more than it was really necessary.
Doctors but also prescribed it.
It's very often,
literally.
Yeah. Yeah, it got some discussions off their neck. They didn't have to spend so much time with the patient, and they gave a prescription, and the prescription fulfilled. Prescription did
what
was really needed.
Right.
But I don't think it's over. It's overdone now. The doctors are well aware of that. Yeah, they are very careful.
Very cautious.
Yeah.
And it's also very much restricted. You can't refill.
No, you can't refill. And even I think he has to write a new prescription in order to have it refilled.
Well, it certainly is a wonder drug, and I am sure that the financial rewards for Hofmann-La Roche were tremendous in these drugs.
Yeah, they were.
What about you?
Well,
you sold the patent for $1, I read.
Yeah, that what it was. I mean, I got a very nice salary increases and extra benefits, and even now, whenever I want to go to a congress, I just have to tell our research director, and he says, oh yes, Roche will pick up the tab. Mm-hmm. Or now I'm getting in Frankfurt an honorary doctorate in June.
And
yeah. So I asked Kunzmann, our research director, can we go? Can I go and my wife? And do we go? Can we go business class? I said, oh yeah, sure. They cover the expenses.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this even came from Basel, came from Grenzach, Germany, which was contacted by Frankfurt that I'm getting the honorary doctorate. By Professor Mutschler or Oehlschläger, one of the professors there, and they gave the order to, they asked Roche, will Roche pick up the trip expenses for the Sternbachs from here to Europe, whereas the European expenses will be covered in Germany or so.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so they treat
so you
me
have
quite
no regrets that you didn't own the patent?
No, well, I could have got much more, but on the other hand, I don't have such expensive hobbies. I mean, I can afford whatever I want to.
What are your hobbies?
Really, well, it used to be skiing. Now I don't do much
skiing
anymore. No, only cross country. Yeah.
On account of the other people.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, only cross country skiing and Otherwise, I mean, I take my vacations. I was in St. Croix. I invited my both sons with their families to St. Croix for a week, and so I can all afford that. In summer, I go to Switzerland in connection with Frankfurt. I will then be in Switzerland.
You go to Switzerland often, don't
you? Yeah, we go almost every year.
But you don't have a place to live there.
We have a small rented apartment in Zurich, a one-room apartment. Mm-hmm. It's very cheap. It's, mm-hmm, I think, something around 500 francs a month. Mm-hmm. And so we have that, and my wife says otherwise she wouldn't go to Europe, mm-hmm, if she doesn't have a place where she can come directly and
not
stay. Yeah, yeah. So we have that, and that we are using now. We will go first there, and then we go by train to Frankfurt, mm-hmm, and we come back, and then we will go to Pontresina for a week, and I invited one of my sons with family.
Is one of your sons in Zurich now?
No, they are both here.
Oh, they're both here.
They are both
He's
here.
He's not at the ETH.
No, he was for a while with Eschenmoser.
Right.
Yeah, he was with Eschenmoser.
Yeah. With Eschenmoser.
With Eschenmoser, yes. Yeah. He's now at Duke University.
He's
assistant professor. And now he's looking for an industrial job, and he might join Merck. It's, mm-hmm, just in the air, the whole thing. Yeah.
I see. Well, going back to the patent, it expired.
Yeah, this patent expired,
yes,
and we are in you know, it goes 17 years.
17 years.
But with Valium, we were very lucky because Wyeth was fighting us, mm-hmm, so we got the patent only 6 years later than we should have got it.
So you got it longer.
Yeah, so we got it for a much longer time. And it expired now in February.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that...
February last year, yeah.
There will be a lot of sale under the generic name?
There are generic volumes on the... diazepams on the market. Mm-hmm. The name is naturally protected for us.
Yes.
It has to be called something else. And...
Is it much cheaper?
It's much cheaper. And you see, you have to, for some of those insurances, you have to prescribe the cheapest drug, or the pharmacy has to give you the cheapest equivalent.
Mm-hmm. It seems to be cheaper in Switzerland.
Yeah, it probably
than
is.
Valium
itself?
Yes,
Valium itself?
I don't know. No reason for that. So is Hoffmann La Roche trying to design new drugs to get new patents?
Well, we are looking
same
for...
line?
No, with the benzodiazepines, I think we
That's
are fairly
finished.
You're
not
involved finished.
In no. Of
no.
it anymore?
No.
Are you doing something else that's...
No, not really.
...interesting and important?
Something, so not really, some research, because I was... My research consisted in working in the laboratory and discovering that way some things. Not on paper. I think on paper you don't invent that much.
Yes. Okay, well, what do you think is the future of drug research? We hear so much about immunology and genetic
engineering. Yeah.
Think that the old molecular modification drug, design, is a thing of the past?
No, I think this is a very good question which I like to answer.
Good.
Because people do as if only molecular biology or genetics can lead to new drugs. And I think there is still the possibility of inventing drugs as we invented the benzodiazepines or as sulfur drugs were invented, and there is still, but this thing is not explored thoroughly because people say the chances are very small, but then if you find something, then it's something completely new, and if you work with old drugs, with the activity of the old drugs, then you can only find drugs which are similar to those.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to look into new classes of chemical compounds in order to find something new.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no reason why not compounds which are completely different from the ones which are now investigated could have some important biological activity.
Yes, yes. And since we know much more about the effect of substituent groups and so on, we...
Well, this you cannot extrapolate. If you know the effect in the benzodiazepine series, that's one thing that stands for the benzodiazepine series. Mm-hmm. And there are, for instance, in antihistaminics or so, the substitution rules are different. The effect of the substituent on the activity is different, and in every class of compounds it's different.
Are computers used to design drugs?
They possibly are, but I don't think they will lead to very much, because you can't feed in it what you want to get out. Mm-hmm. You need the same as garbage in, garbage out. Yes. You have nothing in, nothing out, you know.
Well, I would like to talk a little bit about the many awards and honors that you got, and I'm reading from your curriculum that you have a number of awards. Among those are the American Chemical Society Award in Medicinal Chemistry in 1978, the ACS Award for Creative Invention in 1979, the Karl Mannich Medal from the German Chemical Society in 1984, and these are just a few, and you're an honorary Doctor of the Technical University in Vienna, and the Centenary College in Hackettstown, and now you're going to get the Dr. Phil Nutt Honoris Causa from the Johann Wolfgang Goethe University in Frankfurt. And this is just from a long list of honors. Just mentioning a few.
I think that John Scott Award, that was also Medal Award, that was also a nice thing from Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia. Yeah. And is there anything else you would like to add from this list?
Well, especially the honorary doctorates, they are important, like the Vienna in 71 and the one I'm getting now in Frankfurt, 86.
And you have over 120 publications, five monographs, and you have over 230 U.S. patents.
I emphasize this U.S. patents because all these patents appeared then, maybe in 20 or 30, in some cases in 50 different countries. So I have that many patents in various countries.
In addition to your U.S.
To the U.S. patents. The original ones are all U.S. patents.
And I'm also reading about your practical contributions, the technical synthesis of biotin, which we have discussed. Yeah. And you have Arfonaut.
Yeah, which was an intermediate in the biotin synthesis, and it's a ganglionic blocker, and it's still being used as a short-acting what does it do really? It decreases the blood pressure, it's a very short-acting blood pressure decreaser.
I see. And anticholinergic.
That is against ulcers. Quarzan is Quarzan is the compound which is contained in Librax. Librax is a mixture of quarzan and librium.
I see. It also tranquilizes. And then, of course, we have librium, valium, nobrium.
Yeah. And
Lexotanil, Mogadon, Dalmane, Rohypnol, and an anticonvulsant,
Clonopin, which is in Switzerland Rivotril. It's marketed as Rivotril.
Would you like to add anything to our?
No, really, I don't know really what we have. Everything from the monograph, and we discussed my youth and my whole growing up.
Well, what are you going to do now? You're still a consultant.
Yeah, I'm still a consultant. And
plan to go on?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, they don't consult me very much, but at least I have a space where I can keep my books and.
You have your
everything.
Own secretary?
No, it's not. I have to share. I mean, somehow to get somebody who does things for
but
me.
They'll come in early in the morning.
Yeah, yeah. I leave usually kind of quiet. Yeah, well, my best working hours are the morning hours. Later on, my brain power is going down.
Well, I would say, Dr. Sternbach, that this concludes our interview. Yeah. I would like to thank you so much for your cooperation and your fascinating account of your most interesting life, and I would like to thank you for the contribution to our oral history.
Thank you for your thanks, and it was really a pleasure to talk with you and to tell you all about myself.
You're most welcome.